Today, I'm rocking the suburbs.
Game is my middle name.
Hello, everybody. Patrick here. Just wanted to make a quick introduction to this second part of the excellent, excellent work that patron Bob Peterson has done researching and telling us about the American funk singer Bette Davis. May she rest in power. Truly an underappreciated genius, underappreciated in her time, and it's good to see that now she's starting to get a little more appreciation. And I know a lot of people really liked the first episode of this and are ready to do some deep dives on Bette Davis, so that's very encouraging. And I want to remind everybody that we started off yesterday, and Bob told us about Betty's early years, her relationship with Miles Davis, and we were right up at the point after she had released her second album and had taken her band on tour and really opened some eyes and in some cases pushed people back from the stage. They were so shocked and surprised at what she was doing live. But that's where we're going to pick the story up. And I'm going to go over to the tape player here and hit play, and we're going to hear part two of this patron episode featuring Bob Peterson on Rockin' the Suburbs.
And after her second album that we just talked about, she moved to a bigger label. In 1975, she was going out with Robert Palmer, you know, the singer who was on Island Records.
Yeah.
And Robert Palmer helped her to get a deal with Island and Chris Blackwell. And she kept her band, they call them the Funk House Band, and produced another album with the same tight funk and sexually charged lyrics. And it was really kind of the same story, you know. It was this great music that was critically well received. It was more like a cult band, but it never really gained widespread popularity. There was one single off of there that reached 97 on the R&B charts, so she was actually taking a step backwards, and that was called Shut Off the Light. You know, you said you don't know her very well, Jim. What do you think of the music so far?
I'm really, well, I'll tell you, I'm looking up right now. Where can I buy these records? I'm looking on my phone right here. So I'm telling
you,
this is all me. This is all me. It sounds fantastic. And I also want to say real quickly, when you were talking earlier about how she presented herself on stage and what have you and her image and so on, I was thinking, Bob, you're really good. You're going to be really good for our ratings here on the podcast, I think, right?
Well, so, yeah, I mean, back then she was a ratings killer because it was too much for
right,
people.
I hear
but, yeah, this is amazing.
I hear
so, Bob, I got to ask you one question here.
Sure.
So, how do you think Bette got these sidemen that played with her, right? She always had the hottest bands, right?
Yeah.
All the people. I mean, people have charisma, right? People are on the scene and all that, you know, but what do you think it was about her that, you know, got all these people to play with her and make these amazing backing tracks?
Well, she was charismatic, you know, I mean, she really could charm people. You know, she had a lot of relationships, you know.
Yep.
I think she just was a magnet. You know, she knew how to sell herself. She knew what she wanted. She had a singular mind, and nothing was going to deter her from her goal. So I think she also had a really good ear for music. So she just picked up. But it just so happened this band, the Funkhouse band, you know, a couple of them were her cousins who were very talented, and their friends were very talented. And arguably, that was probably the best band she played with, even though there were all these other talents, because they knew each other and they were much more tight-knit. You know, she knew what she wanted, and she had a good ear. So I think that's why she had good bands.
Yeah, I mean, and what do you think about the Madonna parallel?
There's no comparison. I mean, Madonna had, you know, the performance, but she wasn't writing her songs like this. And she did write songs, it was something kind of, you know, maudlin, like a prayer, you know. I'm sorry. I mean, it's an okay song, but I mean, Madonna had that same vision, but she didn't have the musical chops. Right. She didn't have the ear.
Yeah. Well said.
She was a good, I'm not going to badmouth Madonna. It's just that Betty
you
Davis.
You better not.
No, I'm going to. Actually, you know, and I was going to ask you, you know, I think her creative control, she didn't have a manager even. She had no men.
That was amazing. Yeah. Yeah.
Can you think of anybody from the 70s, any female artists? I can only think of maybe three that had that level of independence. Maybe like Joni Mitchell.
Right.
Or Carole King, or maybe Nina Simone. But that's about it.
Yeah. And, you know, maybe Joan Baez, or, you know, there might have been a couple of other people. But you're right. It was very rare at that point, especially doing this kind of sound. Yeah.
Actually, Joan Baez, is a really good parallel, because she was the same way, uncompromising. Yep. She'd go to jail for her ideals.
Exactly.
You know? I think she would, you know, on opposite end of the, you know, moral spectrum.
It's true,
I guess,
though. But they both were totally committed to what they believed in. Yep. Yep.
Absolutely. Yep. I didn't think of her, but yeah, she's a real good parallel for Betty. But anyways, by this time, Betty was getting a lot of pressure from Island and Chris Blackwell to tone it down. It's like, come on, you can tone it down just a little bit. And she would not compromise. So when they went in for their fourth album, it's an album that eventually was entitled Is It Love or Desire? They recorded it in 1976, and she had the Funkhouse band again. But the rift was so deep that when they finished the album, Island refused to release it. It just sat on the shelves. And there were some speculation that it was, you know, the rift between Betty and, you know, Chris Blackwell, the owner of the label. But there's also some reports that the label never paid the studio in Louisiana where they recorded it. So they held on to the master tapes. But in any event, it did see the light of day in 2009 on Light in the Attic Records. After Island refused to release the album, that's where she basically kind of disappeared off the face of the earth. She just left, never called her band again. That was the last she saw of her band, was when she recorded it. She moved to Japan, and I think she kind of took up like transcendental meditation and Eastern religion. I think she returned to the States in 1979 to try to record another album that was called Crashing from Passion. And I just found out about this really a couple weeks ago while I was researching this on Discogs. And what I read is that she recorded this album, and I don't even know who played on it, but whoever the label was refused to record it, and they sold it to some other people, and it was bootlegged on three different labels. It came out as on Razor and Tie in 1996 on CD. It was also on Peavine Records, which was a Japanese label, in 1995. It was released under another name called Hanging Out in Hollywood. I was so excited to find another Bette Davis record. I bought it off of Discogs, a CD, for $30. I thought that was a deal. But in any event, she disappeared. You know, she couldn't revive her career. And then, like in the early 80s, she finally just moved home with her mom in Pittsburgh. I think there were mental health issues. She was just crushed from, you know, the weight of the record executives. Then her father died, and I think she just became reclusive. You know, from 1980 through up until her recent death, she just lived a very, very quiet life in Pittsburgh. You know, no one heard from her. None of her artists, no one could find her until 2017, when that filmmaker, I forget his name, wanted to put out a documentary, and it's called They Say I'm Different. They found her. She agreed to do it, but she would only do it on her terms. And it's a really interesting documentary because she would not allow them to photograph her face. It was like really artistic shots of her hands or maybe her profile. And you could hear her voice. And there was a lot of artistic imagery. She talked about her muse, which was a black crow. She had a lot of references to some mountain in Japan. But it was very sad because you found out what a great force she was. But in real life, you know, as crazy and wild as she was in her stage persona, she was extremely shy and withdrawn, you know, and didn't drink, didn't do drugs. But the documentary did give her some notoriety again. There was a really sad scene where they reassembled her band, the Funk House Band, and in a studio, and they started playing, and they were trying to coax her on phone to come down and play with them. You know, this was the first time they had talked to him since 1976. And she said hello, exchanged pleasantries, and after a minute said goodbye, you know, and didn't want to have anything to do with getting back together with her band. It was kind of sad, but she was so content in her reclusive life, she didn't want to give it up. But she did show some signs of her musical ability. A couple of years later, she actually wrote a song called A Little Bit Hot Tonight, and then she got a woman from Pittsburgh, a singer named Danielle Maggio, to record it. The singer was actually a grad student studying ethnomusicology at the University of Pittsburgh and recorded one of her songs. But she still had no interest in getting back in the limelight and died, you know, unfortunately, in February 2022, very quiet death. Mm-hmm. But, you know, here she was. I think if I had to talk about her legacy and sum it up, I'd say she's right on par with like Velvet Underground and Big Star, you know. Extremely influential band and never got the credit they deserved. I mean, obviously, VU definitely, I think, has gotten pretty popular. Big Star, she's probably more like Alex Chilton than Lou Reed, but, you know, you read about her influence. Miles Davis said, you know, there would be no Prince or Madonna if it hadn't been for Bette Davis. A lot of singers, you know, they say, you know, women like, you know, Beyonce would never be there if it wasn't for Bette Davis. You know, there are artists like Erykah Badu who claimed she was a big influence. Janelle Monáe was a big, you know, Bette was a big influence. So she did have a legacy. And, you know, the impression I got was she had a cult status. Like all the hardcore funk musicians thought she was, you know, the bomb. She was it. But, you know, it's kind of sad. But I did want to leave off with two things. One is a quote that she had, and this is from the documentary. And then after that, I'm going to play one song from that her last released album called that is kind of autobiographical. It's called Stars Starve, you know, which talks about getting crushed by the music industry and being left broke. And, you know, because she had to do it her way. But anyways, her quote is this. She said, "People tell me I paved the way, that I was part of a struggle. Well, I'm happy about that. I'm happy my music is still alive. For a while in my life, I flew high and strong. But the struggle to break through hurt me. Everyone wanted me to be something I wasn't. In the end, I found I can only be myself. But if I want to leave one thing behind, I want to say that being different is everything. It is the way forward." And I thought, wow, that's great. You know, even in, she has no regrets for doing what she did, you know. It crushed her, but she didn't want to sell out, and she never did, which I think is the highest praise you can give an artist is that they kept their integrity. Story on Betty Davis.
I hope it really educates a lot of people out there.
It was like getting over the head with an anvil when I heard her music. It was like when you hear Big Star for the first time, and it's like, whoa, how could this never have been big? You know, it's amazing. So I hope people enjoy it. But what are your thoughts?
I had one question for you, Bob. She completely went all in, put herself out there as she was, and yet the reaction to that, you know, how do you see that whole thing in parallel with like social media, right? It's like I'm putting my Instagram out there or whatever. Like, how do you see that?
Well, I think she would have done well if MTV was around. Holy cow. I mean, not even social media, but MTV would have been a tremendous vehicle for her. Again, like I say, Madonna is fantastic, but doesn't hold a candle to Betty. I mean, no knock against Madonna, but doesn't hold a candle to her. And Madonna was just the master at marketing herself. And I don't know if MTV would have let Betty be herself. So maybe she would have met the same battles, you know?
Right. But good point.
But I always have the utmost respect for artists who keep their integrity and don't compromise. And I think artists like that should be revered.
Yeah, totally agree. Well, this is really exciting for me because now I got a lot of listening to do.
When this episode airs, I'm going to follow it up with a show on midlife crisis that highlights psychedelic funk, not just Betty Davis, but a lot of the funk artists that were kind of following that hybrid of psychedelic music and rock and funk.
That'd be great.
That sounds great. That'd
be fantastic.
So I want to put a plug in for my radio show. So that'll be my theme is psychedelic
funk. When is
funk.
That again? What time and day is that again?
That's at 4 p.m. Eastern on Thursdays. Part of a great lineup with Eric Didrikson at he's at night, and then there's Nick Sclera and Carl Anfinsen. Oh, and there's some guy who has a really weird show at 5 Eastern. You never can know what to expect because it's just so off the wall, but it's about as fun as freeform radio gets. Patrick. It's truly great.
Thank you, brother.
It's like probably going back to 1972 underground radio.
I love that. Thank you, brother.
That's you great. Betcha.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Bob, for coming on and enlightening us. And
yes.
If any listeners out there are familiar with Betty Davis and want to comment for a future episode, you can call and leave a message on the Suburban Party Line. The number is 612-440-1984. There you go. Or you can leave an email, send an email, rock@suburbspod.com, or hit us up on the social medias at suburbspod on the Instagram and the Twitter and all that. Okay, it's Rock in the Suburbs. I'm Jim Lenihan.
And I'm Patrick Foster.
And with us has been
Bob Peterson.
Thanks, Bob. We'll talk to you all later.
Peace.
No, I don't want to love you, 'cause I know how you are. That's why I've been staying away from you. That's why I haven't called you, 'cause I know you could. could make me scrawl. I know you could have me shaking. I know you could have me climbing walls. That's why I don't want to love you. You are sure you say you're right on and you're righteous, but with me I know you'd be right off, 'cause you know I could possess your body too, don't you? You know I could make you crawl, and just as hard as I'd fall for you, boy. Well, you know you'd fall for me harder. That's why I don't want to love you.
On the Suburban Party Line, the number is 612-440.
I don't know.